Iran slams the new U.S. administration for pressing ahead with a policy of maximum pressure against the Islamic Republic. The Syrian army says it has intercepted most of Israeli missiles fired from the occupied parts of the Golan Heights over Damascus. Political tensions are rising in Myanmar. This is a Southeast Asian country witnessing fresh protests against the recent military coup, despite intensified crackdown. This is World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran says that the United States is still following the wrong policy of maximum pressure by former President Donald Trump as regards the 2015 nuclear deal.
Unfortunately, the new U.S. administration is still acting the same as the previous one. What happens today is not different from what was the condition before January 20th. We see that the maximum pressure campaign and cruel sanctions continue against Iran.
Hatib Zadeh says Washington needs to move away from such policies and act in the right way. He said if the other signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action continue to violate it, Iran will further scale back its commitments. He, however, said that all those actions are reversible on the condition that the other parties to the deal comply with their commitments. He also emphasized that Iran's stance on the peacefulness of its nuclear activities remains unchanged, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution has banned the production and use of any form of mass destruction weapons. Independent geopolitical analyst Brian Barletic has said that the U.S. policy as regards Iran has not changed, despite what the Biden administration claims.
And Iran has signaled its willingness to return to the deal. What the United States now expects Iran to do is return to the negotiation table with parties who have acted in bad faith. They had violated the deal. They proposed this deal to Iran, and then it seemed as if they were trying to deliberately sabotage it so that they could blame Iran for not holding up to its commitments. We remember under the Trump administration, the U.S. accusing Iran of violating it with no evidence at all. And now we see, even though Biden during his campaign said that he was going to reverse this policy, we see that the policy is still very much in effect. And I would just like to point out one other thing about this. U.S. policy papers since 2009 had openly conspired basically to offer this deal to Iran specifically for this purpose, to make it look like the U.S. was trying to be reasonable. They fully planned not to honor it, to walk away from it, and then blame Iran for it. And we could see that unfolding right now, even with the change in the White House.
Now, Iran and Russia are set to hold joint naval drills in the Sea of Oman and also north of the Indian Ocean on Tuesday. The military exercise is aimed at boosting cooperation in naval operations and establishing collective security for shipping in the strategic waterway. Now, to get some more information, let's go live to Konark in southern Iran. We have our own Yusuf Jalali there, and he is going to give us some more information. He's going to get a hold of some Navy top brass, I believe. Let's go to Yusuf and see what he has for us. Yusuf, what's up?
Well, Behrouz, it's a very important drill tomorrow. The Russian and the Iranian navies will conduct a joint drill across a 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean and the Sea of Oman. Well, the drill is the second since December 2019 when the Chinese, Iranian, and Russian navies conducted a trilateral drill. This year, of course, the drill is going to be conducted in a bilateral form between the Russian Navy and the Iranian Navy due to the coronavirus and the social distancing issues. Of course, the Iranian military officials have told us that the Chinese Navy will, of course, hold a similar joint drill with the Iranian Navy later on. The exact schedule will be announced. The drill is codenamed Marine Security Belt, and of course is conducted with the aim of increasing and bolstering the security of north of the Indian Ocean and the Sea of Oman, which is a very strategic waterway that is connected through the Strait of Hormuz to the Persian Gulf. And the Strait of Hormuz is a very strategic choke point which hosts one-fifth of the entire world's oil shipments. So the drill is a very strategic and important drill. The two navies will exercise anti-terrorism operations, search and rescue operations, and of course defense against piracy in this very important waterways. The drill will kick start tomorrow, and will continue for 2 days. The Russian Navy will send its Stoiki corvette and Kola logistic vessel, among other military equipment, to the area, to the location of the drills. The drill is very much significant because the region, this body of water north of the Indian Ocean and the Sea of Oman, are a very strategic waterways due to the fact that 20% of the world's oil shipment is passed through the Strait of Hormuz, right, and the Persian Gulf. And this region is a threat-infested region. And the Iranian Navy says this drill is not going to be a response to the American coalition and the U.S.'s Navy in the region, which has recently held similar joint drills with the Arab states, regional Arab states in the Persian Gulf. This is not a response to those drills, but a show of might and a deterrence to any threat that is facing the region.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much for that update and explanation. Yusuf Jalali, now in southern Iran, in Konarak, the site of the naval drills between Iran and Russia. Now, moving on, a number of government organizations in Yemen have warned that basic services will no longer be available if oil vessels detained by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Our correspondent has the story.
The ministries of health, water, electricity and communication, along with the Yemeni Petroleum Company, have held a press conference in Sana'a to call on the international community to intervene and to stop the collapse of these vital sectors due to the lack of fuel.
The siege has increased and the crisis has exacerbated a lot. We no longer have oil derivatives and there has been no reaction from the international community but useless media statements. We need serious work and real pressure on the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. to allow entry of oil ships because their detention is illegal. These ships have been searched and given permits from the United Nations, who bears responsibility for what Yemenis are facing.
Officials said the country is on the verge of catastrophe as only 11 out of 2,000 gas stations are working. However, 5,000 health facilities, including 15 dialysis centers, may stop providing health services due to lack of fuel, which will cause more loss of lives.
Some medicines need continuous refrigeration. Oxygen factories, intensive care units, emergency rooms and also baby incubators will stop in thousands of health facilities. This will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe and the loss of more lives. Oil derivatives are the basis of the work of all sectors, and we call on the international community to stand with the Yemeni people.
Yemenis are suffering a severe fuel crisis as 12 oil ships are still illegally detained by the Saudi-led coalition for months now, amid the continuous silence of the United Nations and the international community. Millions of Yemenis spend days in long lines to get some liters of petrol, which will be cut off within days unless the international community step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
News review time. Syrian air defense systems have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the capital, Damascus. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, joined us a short while ago and provide us with some more details on that attack.
And just a few minutes ago, the Syrian Army Command issued a statement giving some more details, saying at about 1:18 a.m. Local time here in the Syrian capital, the Israeli side carried out an aggression, firing a number of missiles from the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some Syrian army positions, most probably around the capital, Damascus. Syrian air defenses, according to the Syrian army, were directly activated and shot down most of the enemy missiles. Now, this is not the first time that this happens, for sure. Hundreds of attacks, perhaps, since the start of the crisis in Syria. Israel has been attacking the Syrian army with the aim to undermine the capabilities of the Syrian army, which is fighting terrorists on the ground.
Now, time now to get some insight on that. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He's joining us out of Edinburgh. And also Mimi Alam, Syrian activist and commentator, is joining us from Perth, Australia. Welcome to the show, both of you. Let's go to Edinburgh first. Mick, this has been going on for quite some time. Every now and then we hear about such missile attacks from the Golan Heights, from the Israeli side, and targeting the targets inside Syria. What is that goal that the Tel Aviv regime is pursuing by launching such attacks?
Well, the general policy of Israel since its inception has been that given that it's a relatively small population surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs and other Middle Eastern peoples who at that time were under direct colonial domination, when they became independent, the Israeli strategists realized or theorized that they had to be surrounded by weak states, either devastated or client states of the USA, or states that were oil-rich and population-poor and could not survive without a foreign external protector. So the use of violence, I mean, Israel's the only country, I think, there may be some contenders, but I think it's the only country in the world which has attacked all its neighbors repeatedly, and the state still remains there. I think maybe one new factor could be the arrival of Joe Biden. I mean, in many ways, he'll signal continuity with Trump, but there are some differences. And it may be that given that Netanyahu is waiting for a phone call, this could be a message to Washington that, look, you need us in order to attack and control neighbors who are not dancing to the tune from Washington. So it could be that. But Israel has this long-term record of violence against its neighbors until they sue for peace. Or in the case of Lebanon, where Israel suffers a very, very dramatic reversal and military defeat. So I don't think it's a surprise. I think Israel wishes to see Iraq devastated, wishes to see Syria devastated. And if there's any threat of peace breaking out in Syria, then Israel would wish to prevent that at all costs. I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. This comes out time after time in the public domain. I mean, only a few years ago, Netanyahu thanked Secretary of State Kerry under the Obama regime for protecting Israel's nuclear monopoly and ability to terrorize the whole region, quite openly, when every power in the region wanted a nuclear-free Middle East, except Israel. So this violence against Syria comes against a back of this is what Israel does. I mean, Israel sees itself in the horrible language of one of its prime ministers as a villa in the jungle. It's an outpost of Europe and America among savages, and all they understand is violence, really.
Right. Now let me turn to Perth, to Mimi Alahem. Is this one of the reasons why Tel Aviv insisting on keeping the occupied Golan Heights under occupation to launch such attacks against Syria? And also let's consider the fact that we have had these attacks all along in the past few years, you know. And recently you see that the air defense battery of the Syrian government is acting even more efficiently, and this time they intercepted several of those missiles.
Yes, Well, the good thing is that with training now, the Syrian air defense is very well equipped to shoot down these missiles. Unfortunately, you know, last time this attack happened, the Israelis managed to slaughter an entire family, including children. So the air defense systems are not foolproof. And I fear that the only real way to stop these attacks from happening is to retaliate in kind. And Syria, unfortunately, is not in a position to do that because of the war, Al-Qaeda taking over the northwest of the country and the U.S. occupying the east of the country. And that is why Israel is taking advantage of such a situation. And, of course, they want to keep the war going as long as possible. But more so, you know, at the core of this, this is Israel's modus operandi. Because what we have to remember is that at the end of the day, Israel is just another terrorist group. Since their inception, they were created by Jewish terrorist groups that attacked Palestinian civilians and British soldiers alike in order to create a religious state. And the Golan Heights does give them a strategic position because of the elevated status that it has. It can, you know, see a lot more of Damascus, and they can fire missiles at a longer range. But there's also a religious element to the Golan Heights, which they feel it belongs to them because they think that God gave it to them. And that is why, you know, this is basically the Jewish ISIS. And you can't make peace with it. It's impossible. Normalization is absolutely a ridiculous idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God gave it to them. We wonder what God gave to the Palestinians. Okay, thank you very much for your contributions. Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joined me from Edinburgh. And Mimi Al-Lahem, Syrian activist and commentator from Perth. And that's it for this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. In Myanmar, anti-coup protesters defy an intensified crackdown by the military and take to the streets in several cities. Hundreds of university students have rallied in Myanmar's largest city of Yangon. There has been a similar demonstration in the southern city of Dawei. The fresh rallies came as the military deployed extra vehicles and soldiers around the country in an effort to quell an uprising against their seizure of power 2 weeks ago. The junta also imposed an hours-long internet shutdown, and that after protests turned violent on Sunday when security forces fired at demonstrators and arrested journalists. The situation has been tense in Myanmar after the military toppled the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on the first day of February. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zaid As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another episode of For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali As-Sajjad's treatise of rights. We're talking about the rights of the adversary, someone who is making a claim against you, and this claim is false. How do you deal with it? And we've said in the last segment where Imam As-Sajjad got to this particular point where he is saying that if you were going to say something harsh, if you're going to say something bad, if you're going to say something irrelevant, then it's going to be used against you. لِأَنَّ لَفْضَةَ السُّوءِ تَبْعَثُ الشَّرِّ. Because a bad statement, something, a bad words, indecent words, will bring about evil. Now, you're not going to be comfortable when someone's accusing you of something, and naturally you're going to want to react. But at the same time, you need to make sure that conflict and aggression and opposition and these kind of things doesn't exceed your boundaries of reason and religion. And we know that power can be given and power can be taken. We shouldn't be comfortable in feeling that we are so strong in our approach to what it is that we are doing. We are invincible. That's never going to be the case. Because in the words of Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he is saying, those who are the owners of the truth and they choose the right way to reach these rights and not try to use the privilege to achieve the rights, because they cannot come to the right way in the right path through aggression or anything else, they will, of course, be compensated. But when you do something that is damaging and that something that is wrong and bad and non-ethical, then of course this is going to be having a lot of bad damages as well in the society. Because the ethics of the individual, the ethics of the community, the ethics of religion and humanity is aimed at educating people. So that this is the struggle, and it does not form at all unless there are events that are going to be leading to a correct and healthy kind of society. And we can examine this issue in different directions and from different angles. One of these ways is, for example, looking at the jurisprudential side of all of this. You know, where in Islamic law, for example, it's forbidden, it's prohibited, it's haram to accuse someone, to slander someone. And this is an issue that is dealt with in the core aspect of our Sharia law. And according to our teachings as well, using vulgar language or using indecent words or using accusations or things like that is very, very reprimanded and condemned. You know, hostility towards someone is going to disrupt the harmony of society. You're going to ruin fellow human beings' happiness. And that's, of course, very, very harmful. And the effects of this great religion has always been committed in such a way that hostility and hatred be avoided and not take shape in any which way or form, whether it is towards someone who you are in conflict with, or whether it's on the basis of you assuming it be an honorable thing or a dignifying thing, or in any of the affairs of this world. We're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we can see that when it does come to you wanting to live a dignified life, an honorable life, you know, we can see, unfortunately, in today's courts, in today's world, that there's so much hostility, so much enmity, so much hatred, so much conflict, that in the initial dialogue, it leads to fundamental problems. It's an all-out battle between two sides. You know, and if a human being wants the worst of someone, you know, they will, of course, enter into these things. But what Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is trying to teach us here is, if you want the best from yourself and you want the best for humanity, never enter into conflict, never enter into confrontation. And that's why Imam As-Sadiq, peace be upon him, he says a wonderful hadith. He says, وَلَا يَقْبَلُ اللَّهُ مِنْ مُؤْمِنٍ عَمَلًا. Allah will not accept any deed from a believer, وَهُوَ مُضْمِرْ عَلَىٰ أَخِيهِ الْمُؤْمِنِ سُوءٍ. When this person is harboring malice intent towards their fellow brethren believer. وَهُوَ مُضْمِرْ. They're harboring, they're hiding. عَلَىٰ أَخِيهِ الْمُؤْمِنِ, towards their fellow believing brother, سوء, evil, that they want, they're harboring evil towards them, that they want to intend to inflict harm on their fellow brother or sister. As we can see, our effort here is to make a person of realization, a person of submission to Almighty God, a believer, and being far away from any thought of these kind of issues. If so, any conflict in society, will there such a thing occur? Absolutely not. There will be no conflict in society. And therefore, the efforts of the Imam alayhi salam on these two issues are in educating the human beings so they do not basically allow the seed of hostility and conflict to be planted in this in the hearts of the believers, and also another reminder, a necessary reminder, that there is an issue of rights that needs to be observed from two sides of the believers. The point is here that our education is in the event of dealing with hostility and conflict and making it insignificant and turning away from it, especially with what it is that we are going to say. Because, as he says, Imam Sajjad says, لَفْظَةَ السُّوءِ تَبْعَثُ الشَّرِ, because bad statements is going to lead to animosity and evilness. Why? Because when you are reacting in a certain way, you're going to be saying bad things, you're going to be saying cruel things, you're going to be saying evil things, and these kind of accusations is going to escalate and turn into you aggravating them and turning into you provoking them, and you might say something extra, and you are being accused of something, and then now all of a sudden you are accusing them of something, you are saying something inappropriate to them as well. This kind of attitude is of course very, very wrong, because you know, the hadith says that, you know, this is going to be a seed that is going to lead to something even worse. We'll continue on explaining this segment from Imam As-Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq in our next program. Please visit us on www.parstoday.com or email us through englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program at For Humanity, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyil azim.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter, the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, abstention. Egypt, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Soviet Union, yes.
United Kingdom, abstain. United States, yes. Paraguay, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israeli flag was hoisted outside the United Nations just after this session. When the UN General Assembly voted on the partition plan for Palestine, the Zionists did not keep the great powers waiting. The representative of the Jewish agency at the UN told the members of the Security Council what they were waiting for.
Not later than May 16th next, a provisional Jewish government will commence to function in cooperation with the representatives of the United Nations, then in Palestine.
But in the first step, the White House acted against the Zionist expectations.
America,
the U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons: Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should, therefore,
carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. Shortly before this announcement, Eliyahu Epstein, head of the Jewish Agency in Washington, wrote to the U.S. President that the Act of Independence would become effective at 1 minute after 6 p.m. on May 14, 1948, Washington time. With full knowledge of the deep bond of sympathy which has existed and has been strengthened over the past 30 years between the government of the United States and the Jewish people of Palestine, I have been authorized by the provisional government of the new state to tender this message and to express the hope that your government will recognize and will welcome Israel into the community of nations. Later, just 11 minutes past 6 p.m., Harry Truman wrote to the UN General Assembly despite George Marshall's disagreements.
This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
The happiness of forming a Jewish homeland on the Promised Land did not last long. The very next day, when David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence at the Tel Aviv Museum, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, angry with their new uninvited neighbor, attacked Israel. The fledgling Israel had no aircraft nor tanks, and the Arabs were superior against the Zionists in the number of fighters and arms, and their victory seemed certain. The same theory turned into reality, and the Arabs achieved significant victories. The Zionists saw with their own eyes that the Jewish homeland was on the edge of destruction. David Ben-Gurion and his companions had to do something, so they went around the world to buy weapons. Finally, Czechoslovakia and Russia sold arms to Israel. The weapons of the Eastern Bloc changed the equation of power on the battlefield. Arabs were optimistic and participated with part of their power in the war, but they were unsuccessful. The UN was under the US pressure to declare a ceasefire to end the Arab-Israeli conflict and pressured the Arabs to sign a ceasefire agreement with Israel. After 9 months of fighting in vain, the ceasefire put an end to the conflict. The Arabs did not accept the peace agreement with Israel because peace meant the recognition of the State of Israel. The Arabs accepted the ceasefire, not peace. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent. The Suez Canal Company was owned by Britain for many years, but the new Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, gave a fervent speech on July the 26th, 1956, in Alexandria, announcing the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Then he raised the flag of his country in that region as the sign of this nationalization. All assets of Suez International Company, most of which belonged to Britain and France, were frozen. The French, who resented the Egyptian aid to the Algerian revolutionaries, in addition to the Suez affair, held a secret meeting in Paris with the British, who had been deprived of the huge Suez Canal shipping revenue. This top-secret meeting had a very special guest, Israeli representative Shimon Peres. The French and British believed that they had to inveigle Israel into invading Egypt in order to take revenge on Gamal Abdel Nasser. They knew that Nasser banned Israeli ships and planes from passing through the Strait of Tiran a year earlier in 1955, and this act could have provoked Israel to attack Egypt. Their ideas attracted Peres's attention, and he soon returned to Israel to inform David Ben-Gurion of their secret offer. Ben-Gurion began working on the plan and was sure that it could alleviate the situation. Nasser predicted the war and asked the United States to buy weapons. But Washington refused it because of the 1950 tripartite agreement on the Middle East among the US, France, and Britain. The agreement banned selling arms to countries in the region to prevent an arms race. So Gamal Abdel Nasser reached out to the Soviet Union for economic and military assistance. Czechoslovakia agreed to give arms to Egypt. The proximity of Egypt and the Eastern Bloc could have intensified the Cold War. On October the 29th, 1956, the Israelis invaded the Sinai Desert. A week later, they occupied it. French fighter jets also provided security for Israeli ground forces in Sinai against the powerful Egyptian Air Force. Israel ignored the importance of power. The United States, which was furious with Israel over its alliance with France and Britain, repeatedly pressured the United Nations Security Council to do something about a temporary ceasefire. On October the 13th, the UN Security Council convened and voted on a draft resolution urging Israel to withdraw its forces to establish a temporary ceasefire. But the resolution was vetoed by France and Britain, and the Soviet Union proposed a similar resolution that had no better fate than the previous one. Dwight D. Eisenhower, then President of the United States, appeared on camera and spoke on behalf of his nation.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities. I therefore have no plan to call the Congress in special session. Of course, we shall continue to keep in contact with congressional leaders of both parties. It is our hope and intent that this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem. In the past, the United Nations has proved able to find a way to end bloodshed. We believe it can and that it will do so again.
The dispute between the permanent members of the Security Council over the ceasefire was not resolved, and as a result, the UN General Assembly convened a special emergency meeting at the request of the Security Council and issued the ceasefire order by 57 votes. But France and Britain ignored the decree. When Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet Prime Minister, noted the situation of his communist ally, issued an ultimatum to France and Britain to destroy London and Paris with atomic bombs if they did not stop invading Egypt. The next day, the military offensive against Egypt ceased. On November the 14th, the first UN peacekeeping troops were deployed in the area, so the Israeli forces left Sinai. The UN flag established a 10-year ceasefire between Egypt and Israel. This fruitless retreat benefited Abdel Nasser more than anyone else. Nasser was about to become an irreplaceable hero of Arab dreams. In May 1967, when Egyptian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Anwar al-Sadat went to Moscow to meet the Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, he was secretly told that Israel had gathered all its forces on the Syrian border. Anwar al-Sadat was asked to inform Abdel Nasser, the man who became the hero of the Arabs by nationalizing the Suez Canal. This mischievous news from the Russians was in fact a kind of incitement to provoke Egypt to attack Israel. The Soviet Union liked to witness a war in the Middle East, so the power in East and West would be in favor of the communists.
We think that in the political plan, even if the war ends in nothing,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
The Egyptian army did not report any movements on the Syrian-Israeli border, but the Russians again confirmed the news. In any case, Nasser did not take the risk and ordered his defense minister, Abdel Hakim Amer, to be ready to attack Israel if Israel invaded Syria. Russia's plan to start a war in the Middle East was turning into reality. Abdel Nasser wrote a letter to the United Nations calling for the withdrawal of peacekeeper troops stationed on the Israeli-Egyptian border since the nationalization of the Suez Canal, so that the Egyptian army could take stand. This measure drew all the attention to Sharm el-Sheikh port in Sinai. Egypt took the initiative and closed the Strait of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba again. By doing so, the Zionists' water connection with the east of the world was completely cut off. Egypt blocked the only way for Israeli oil transfer, and that meant the declaration of war.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
Ah! This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.